would give for that wonderful phrase, to hear those three little words. That's all I'd live for the rest of my days.
Patricia T. O'Connor joins us now. She's the author of any number of books on the English language, and they just keep on coming out new editions, don't they? Two
yes.
new editions coming out?
Well, Origins of the Species is coming out in paperback next week, and it's got a few little updates in it.
Well, does the language need updating?
Oh, of course. Even that book, which is about myths, I mean, there were little anti-datings and things like that that needed to be fixed between editions.
I've never dated an anti.
Oh, well, you're such an uncle, you know. But no, Woe Is I, the original book, came out in its third edition last year, and the paperback of that came out last month. And each time it's reprinted, it's updated.
And meanwhile, you keep on getting all sorts of suggestions from our listeners who write to you.
Yes.
At gramophobia.com.
Right.
And, of course, we get all the calls that come in during this segment. Our number here, by the way, is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And, you know, even in the time between your visits,
I get
things sent to me to forward to you.
Mm-hmm.
People think about the language and they feel they just have to share it.
They do. I mean, that's the idea for what I wanted to talk about today, partly. It comes from a listener named Doug in Omaha.
Nebraska?
Omaha, Nebraska. Is there another Omaha?
I don't know.
But he asks, basically his question is, are you a Luddite if you're not on Facebook or Twitter? And he says the head of the U.S. Bureau of Consumer Protection has described himself as, quote, essentially a Luddite, unquote, because he's not on Facebook or Twitter. And Doug says, I thought a Luddite was someone opposed to technological change, but now it's apparently someone who isn't technologically with it. What do you think? Well, I think what's happened is that Luddite has taken on new life in the electronic age. And this is interesting because this is a word that was born in another period of great technological upheaval, the Industrial Revolution. When the term first came into being in the early 19th century, a Luddite was a member of an organized band of English mechanics and their friends who set themselves to destroy manufacturing machinery in the Midlands and the north of England.
Now, this follows the creation of another word by people who were doing something similar, sabotage.
Oh,
where
yes.
people were throwing
exactly.
their wooden shoes into machines.
Exactly. It was the same thing. And in the north of England.
And sabotage no longer means anything like throwing wooden shoes into machinery.
No. It can even mean something psychological. But the Luddites were against the Industrial Revolution was very hard on labor. I mean, as many historical movements, it meant big change in the way the working classes made their livings. And the reason you see the word Luddite capitalized is because it's said to be based on the name of a real person. He may be mythical.
Ned Ludd.
Ned Ludd, yes, sometimes spelled with one D, sometimes with two. And he may not have really existed, we don't know, but the stories were that he was someone of weak intellect, or feeble-minded, if you will, who lived in a Leicestershire village in 1779, in a fit of insane rage, he rushed into a hosiery maker's house and started destroying the frames that were used for knitting stockings. And as a result, people started saying whenever a stocking frame was damaged or some other vandalism like this happened, people started saying, Ludd must have been here. Which led, again, in the early 1800s to the word Luddite. Luddite, someone who set out to destroy this technological advance.
So let's get to today. Now, we recently had dealings with somebody who doesn't have a computer, a famous person who surely could afford a computer but chooses not to have one. So that means no internet, no email, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Is that person a Luddite or is that a person who just chooses to live a more traditional life?
Well, I think you can say that that person is a Luddite. According to the OED, and I'm talking about the last incarnation of this definition, which was only written in 1989, a Luddite was someone who opposes the introduction of new technology, not somebody who sets out to blow it up, but someone who opposes it, and Luddism, intense dislike of or opposition to a technological advance. Now, this was from the 80s, and that definition, and I think things have changed again since then.
Well, but we can also make distinctions. For example, I do use a computer, and I use email. First of all, I have to because it's part of my job. But I used to have a phone that had a camera, and it kept on shocking me every time I opened it, and suddenly I started seeing my own foot. So I traded it in for a phone that doesn't have a camera.
Yes, it is
a cell phone, but all it does is take calls as far as I know. It has games. I've never bothered.
Oh, I can beat that. My phone just does phone calls.
Now, are we Luddites because we don't have an iPhone or a BlackBerry?
We don't have a Kindle app on our phones for reading books.
No.
Well,
can't watch movies on your phone?
I think we can call ourselves Luddites because
I
think that word has evolved in the age of iPads and smartphones and all this. It has evolved so that now people use it humorously, and they merely mean that they aren't on the cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have the latest thing, I think you can describe yourself as a Luddite. But it doesn't have that old, oh, let's get out there and blow up the means of production sort of.
Yeah, I don't care if other people spend half their day tweeting and checking out what's on their Facebook pages. I have other things to do.
Yes. No, I think it's fair to use the word Luddite there because I think it's evolved.
My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, and we're talking about the language. I don't know whether you're a Luddite or not, but if you're not a Luddite, you can send us a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. By the way, we are tweeting this segment. We just tweeted information about this segment. I don't know whether there's a certain amount of irony there.
I think you have to give up that Luddite title. I don't think you deserve it anymore if you're tweeting.
Well, I'm not tweeting. I have staff that tweets for me.
Okay.
But, of course, I have to approve what's being tweeted. In many cases, it's simply announcing that we're doing something, which is perfectly fine with me.
Well,
I have to admit, I
tweet too. Well, Stuart does our tweeting, but we tweet daily about what's on our blog.
Mm-hmm. Our number here, by the way, if you prefer to use the more old-fashioned approach, is 212-433-9692. That's area code 212-433-WNYC. And maybe we should go to a couple of calls. What do you think?
Sounds good.
Okay, I'm using the most up-to-date telephone system here. So now, in some cases, I guess I would be a Luddite if I weren't forced to use these new technologies. I make it a rule to know just enough.
I do too.
This phone system that we use on the air probably has all sorts of applications or apps, as some people are apt to say, that I don't know about and don't care to know about. But I know how to put a telephone call on the air. Isn't that good?
That is good.
And Joel from Westchester, you're on.
Ah, hi. Careering and careening, they're used interchangeably now, and it seems as though the latter has become the choice, so there's a career in careering.
Yeah, we see less careering these days. It used to be that careering meant, unless I'm mistaken, bouncing back and forth, going side to side across the road, careering out of control. A car would career out of control, not careen out of control. Because to careen meant to list to one side.
Oh, So it's the difference between a boat and a car?
Well, I don't think it has to be a boat and a car. But
I think it's a difference between somebody who pursues a career or decides to dance on the stage, a Corrine, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly. But I think career is one of those verbs that's probably going to get swallowed up in Corrine. So Corrine is going to mean both tip to one side as well and bounce back and forth, yeah, out of control.
And there's an instance where a noun, career, has become a verb?
I think...
But it isn't the same meaning, even.
No.
Thank you for calling us.
Okay.
We go now to Dale from Manhattan. Dale?
Hi, I'm enjoying the segment, but I think a folk etymology crept into your discussion.
Uh-oh.
And that's the word sabotage. I didn't get out all my reference works, but I think you'll find that the first reference to that word was to a French railroad strike in the late 19th century that reported that the strikers were sabotaging the locomotives to terrorize the workers who'd been brought in to operate the trains. And they were doing that by removing or disabling the brake shoes, or sabots. And
well, that's not what my dictionary says.
It sabotage.
Dale, my dictionary says, and I just opened it up because I knew you were going to correct me, a wooden shoe, a sabot is a wooden shoe worn in some European countries. And then it says sabotage, destruction of property or obstruction of normal operations, treachery. Wait, where is it? To commit sabotage against using the word sabot. Look up sabot, the
yeah.
shoe.
It does mean wooden shoe, but the first time the word is used in English is in reference to railroads.
Okay. Well,
if you can
say
find
it here.
A reference
does it say
to
it in your
wooden
book?
Shoes being thrown into machinery, then I will give up the point. But actually, the French use of it referred to brake shoes on locomotives.
I'm willing accept that.
If that's true, when Stuart and I do the next edition of Origins of the Species, that should be a myth that we would examine.
Yes, I do. I think that I did look it up once years ago in the OED, and the first references are in like the 1880s.
Mm.
And the term became popularized by the industrial workers of the world then in the early 20th century. But it doesn't really have a life before that, before industrial sabotage, which had to do with trains.
Okay.
Very interesting. Thank you.
And now we take a call on the word Luddite. Hi, Marianne from Westchester.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the importance, again, of the activity of destroying. Ludd never would have become a well-known person, or his activity would never have become an active word if it had not been for the fact of his destructive events that he caused.
Right.
I think that you, Leonard, are simply not a Luddite for making an economic choice not to buy something. That's not destructive. It is both with sabotage and Luddite, the very important fact of doing the act of destroying is what made people. It was throwing the wrench into the works and making sure that it couldn't be used. I mean, in our societies, both European and American, if you think about killing somebody, that's one thing. But if you even start to take the steps, then you become implicated. It's very important for our language for us to be making these distinctions.
Well, I think one thing you have to remember about language, though, is that meanings change over time. 200 years ago, Luddite meant a person who sets out to destroy something. It had changed even by the mid-20th century just to mean someone opposed to or disinclined to take advantage of technological advances. And now it means someone who just is behind the curve a bit. So language changes.
But I'd like to believe that I am saving the world from a lot of very bad photographs on my telephone.
Which, you are. And also using up
all that
AT&T tower space.
Yes.
Yes.
We have to take a little break, and we'll be back with more of your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at wnyc.org. My guest is Patricia T. O'Connor, and Origins of the Species by Pat and her husband Stuart Kellerman will be out in paperback next week from Random House. The paperback of the new third edition of Pat's book, Woe Is I, came out last month from Riverhead Books. Boy, you are sure fighting that Kindle, aren't you?
Oh, not exactly. I think we're available on Kindle, too.
Three little words, oh, what I'd give for that wonderful...
We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor and taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Also, comments left on our show page and on our Facebook page. Andy left a comment on my Facebook page saying, having more and different ways to communicate is hardly a bad thing. My least favorite form of communication is having people leave me telephone messages and voicemails. I much prefer email, texting, and social media. Now, that's the way Andy likes to do things. I prefer to hear people's voices, to each his own, right?
I do, too.
Is one better than the other?
Well, I guess if you're getting thousands of voicemails, that might be a hassle, but I don't get that many.
Yeah.
So it's not that much trouble. And I can sort of tell from the person's voice if it's urgent, whether I need to get back to him right away.
Another person, Hillary, left a comment on my Facebook wall saying, FB has changed the way I round up friends for an evening out. One status post asking who is free is much more convenient than a volley of phone calls. It's also revolutionized the way my band promotes our shows.
Hmm.
So
that's good.
And I think that probably is. Also, when we're sending out emails, we can send out emails to individuals or we can send them out to a large group. And
that's true.
And that's always convenient
that's
without
handy.
Having to type in each person's name.
I agree with that.
Ken on the Upper West Side left a comment on our show page saying, there's a possible alternative to Luddite. Someone once described herself to me as a techno peasant. And I like that.
Well,
I always like that and have used it since to describe myself on occasions.
There's another epithet, I guess, for that whole class of people, analog. One of my friends over the weekend complained that Stuart was analog, I guess because he didn't have a smartphone yet. That's a little kinder than saying techno peasant, I think.
Mm-hmm. But we're all digitalized today, aren't we, whether we want to be or not?
Yeah, it's true.
We go now to Joel from New York. Hi, Joel. You're on there. Joel, are you there?
Hi. Yes, I am. Hello.
Hello. If you're there, no prob.
I'm sorry?
I was making a joke, Joel. I know you want to talk about no problem as opposed to you're welcome.
Yeah, I think it's dismissive and it's, if it was a problem, you wouldn't do it, whatever the action might be. And it's, as obnoxious as I found whatever to be, I thought it was dismissive and curt. And
well, when you say a waiter brings your order and puts it down in front of you, and you say thank you to him, and he said, instead of you're welcome, he says, no problem. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about its general use, whether it's with youngsters or adults in whatever walk of life, educational level and social strata and so forth.
Does it bother you if you say it in a foreign language and the other person says de nada?
Or,
no.
Well, isn't that saying no problem in effect?
Actually, in many languages, people say essentially no problem. Stuart and I wrote about this on our blog once. You could get it by going to our page and searching the blog. But we did an item about no problem. And it's in many languages, and I don't think it's always dismissive. I just think it's for a lot of people, it's a little bit of a verbal tick. Maybe they overuse it a bit. But all in all, I think it's, if you'll pardon the expression, no problem.
And I think, Joel, if you wait a little while, it'll go the way of all sorts of other verbal tics that we've had in the past. Remember when people said, where's the beef all the time?
I'm glad that one's gone.
Eve from Long Island. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about the phrase, listen up.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to appear out of nowhere, and I don't know why I find it annoying. So I wonder, where did it come from, and why are people using it?
I haven't researched that one, but I have a feeling it's probably originated in the military, maybe from, sergeants getting the recruits to pay attention, listen up. That's just a guess. I'll have to do some research on that. Maybe I'll do an item for the blog about that.
Okay.
Okay, and I'm sure that some listeners will be calling in to also tell us.
I'm sure.
Maybe the guy who corrected me on sabotage knows about this one, too. John from Paramus. Hi, you're on the air.
How are you guys doing? Very good. You know, all this talk about sabotage in the workplace and everything, I always wondered, what's the origin or the of rank and file? I always never could figure that out in labor terms and whatnot.
Rank and file comes from, it's a description of what it looks like visually when you have things on a grid. You have rows going across, and those are the ranks, the rows going across, and the files are what go down. Either that or I have it the opposite way. One of them is vertical, one of them is horizontal. A rank goes one way and a file goes the other. And the ranks cross the files.
Actually, I've never heard that used unless they're voting on a union contract or something like that.
I know. It came to be used in labor language. But that's another one that I've researched and I've done a blog item about, and now I can't remember what I said, but it's been a few years.
Don't feel bad about
it. Very much.
You know, people sometimes will ask me, what was on your show today?
You'll say,
and I blank out. And it wasn't that it wasn't wonderful while I was doing it, but you did it. You moved on.
I think
and if somebody reminds you, then it all comes rushing back.
Sure.
That's what Proust was writing about.
Exactly.
Okay. Natalie from Westchester. Hi, you're on the air.
Okay, I want to go back to the Luddites for a second. Okay, because I think that something inherent in both the word Luddite and both the word sabotage is like, it's like an active choice. Like, it's an act to do it. So my question was, like, if you actively choose not to get the smartphone, even though it might enhance your ability to check your emails and to Google things, and if you actively choose maybe to participate in the Facebook, because you realize that it's important to a lot of people in your life and a lot of, like, the networking that happens, but you choose not to tweet because it's just a little too much, like, does that make you a Luddite because it's the active, like, I don't know, almost like the meta knowledge that, like, you're making that choice not to participate in it. It's not that you're behind the curve.
Mm-hmm.
You could do it if you wanted to, but you don't really want to go there.
Now, I want to extend this even further.
Legitimate.
I want to extend this further.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There was a time when everyone took a bath, and then showers were developed. And there are some people who still prefer to take baths. Are they Luddites if they decide not to take a shower? How far are we going to go with this?
Okay, I like
a
bath.
Go further back, and you could ask, like, what about when people started to take baths on a daily?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Like,
were all the dirty people Luddites?
Exactly.
They definitely were to be avoided, but that's a whole other matter.
Or were they just behind the curve?
Well, I like to take a bath, but I like to finish up by showering when I rinse my hair. So I've made that choice to, I choose to shower, but I choose it in its place. So
interesting. It's hard to wash hair in the bath if you have really long hair.
Yes. But I guess I'm a Luddite in as far as some things. I've chosen to Twitter only this much and no more. So I think that the caller is right. I've made a choice about that, and I've chosen to draw a line. So
all right.
It's sort of the way that people were drawing their lines back in the Industrial Revolution, only they were doing it violently. I'm not being violent about it.
No, nonviolent version. I'm a nonviolent Luddite.
Yes.
Natalie, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Reminder, our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And a listener has written into the show page with something that we have discussed in the past, but I'll bring it up one more time because it now seems to have a new resonance. When did inline become online, as in standing in a queue? I'm wondering if it's changed because of the internet. And, of course, it's not true. This inline and online are regional, aren't they?
Yeah. I've also done a blog item about those.
Do you remember it?
No. I remember that in the East, standing online has been around for a very long time. It's nothing new. That you get online, you stand online. In the Midwest and in the West, you get in line and you stand in line. You wait your turn in line. And the guy at the behind the deli counter says, next online.
Well, next
out
in
here
line.
And next in line.
Although they're saying
there.
saying something else these days.
The following customer.
Following guest or. They have all sorts of euphemisms
guest,
now.
Yes, yes.
It really, I find
strange.
It disconcerting.
Yes, yes.
No, I'm just here to pay my bill.
Yeah.
I want to pay for the groceries. Archie from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. Yeah. I wanted to comment about the phrase, Gertrude Stein's phrase, a rose is a rose is a rose, and its origin.
Mm-hmm. Well, its origin was with her. And what she said was, and I believe it started with no article. She said, rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. And she was referring to a friend named Rose.
But
in
she,
the beginning.
I read a comment by her on this. She said that it also had to do with the problem that a modern poet faces. She said, when Homer said, oh, moon, the moon came alive in the listener's mind.
But so all he had to say was moon. He didn't have to say, had to describe it.
But she said by the time she came along in the 20th century, you could not just say, oh, rose or a rose. So she said by saying a rose is a rose is a rose, she put the dew on the rose for the first time in 20 centuries.
Yes, but what she said was rose is a rose is a rose is a rose.
Mm.
She was talking originally about a person named Rose.
Well,
Rose is a rose.
I'm not a rose,
scholar,
et cetera, so I don't know about that part.
I wanted to bring up something that a listener in Brooklyn wrote in to me because I think this is interesting. His name is Al from Brooklyn, and he's been married to his wife for 48 years. He says, he emailed me, last night I made the mistake of telling my wife that she looks worse with makeup than without. She claimed that meant that she looks bad without makeup. I cited the dictionary as saying that one of the meanings of worse is less good, and I thought I had given her a good example. And he, in other words, he didn't mean to insult her. And what I answered was that I'm surprised she didn't throw him out for this because the problem was worse is a comparative form of bad. The forms are bad, worse, worst. So when he said she looks worse with makeup than without, he was saying in general she looks bad. But if he had used better, which is a comparative form of good, it would have been more diplomatic.
This sounds like a minefield, no matter what you say.
He should have said, she looks better without makeup than with it. But what he said was, she looks worse with makeup than without. He thought he was saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The idiot.
Mm-hmm.
So, at any rate.
He should have gone to husband school.
Yes, he should. And if your starting point is good, and in describing your wife it should be, then use a comparative or superlative form of good, not a comparative or superlative form of bad.
What he should have said was, honey, you're beautiful.
You're fabulous.
With makeup on and without makeup.
Yes, exactly. Well, now he knows.
Neil from Morristown. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
You know, I think I heard today the death knell for the injunction about using a preposition at the end of the sentence. I was listening to Obama, who's one of the most articulate people that I've heard, and he was talking in Ohio about the economy and about we're going to have to see where it is at. And I'm figuring that if Obama's starting to use this, then we are truly downward spiral with that particular.
Well, I tell you, the problem with that isn't putting a preposition at the end, because there's nothing wrong with putting a preposition at the end of a sentence. That's a myth. Nothing wrong with it at all. The problem there is that he didn't need the word at. It was redundant.
Yeah.
He just should have said where it is.
Yeah. But I think that when people are just trying to sound down, they say,
yes,
well, that's where it's at.
Yeah. And he's talking to people in Columbus and trying to be
Mensch. That's what they talk in Columbus, Ohio.
Right.
To ask Pat a question, you can email her directly at mailbox@gramophobia.com. You can also click on Pat's blog at gramophobia.com to see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners. And remember, Origins of the Specious, her book with her husband, Stuart Kellerman, will be out in paperback next week from Random House. We'll be seeing you next month, and it's always a pleasure to have you on our show.
Thank you for having me.